May it please the court, my honorable opponent, I blame my recounsel for appellant David Barron. The probate court's decision allowing the garnishment in this case is contrary to decisions of this court and the Supreme Court that uphold and enforce spendthrift provisions in trusts against proposed garnishments. The probate court here failed to follow those decisions, Snyder, Brasser, and University National Bank, in allowing the funds to be garnished out of the liquidating trust. First, the liquidating trust is not a self-settled trust, and the probate court committed reversible error in concluding otherwise. A self-settled trust is one in which a creator of the trust, the settlor, is also the beneficiary of the trust. We don't have that here. Here it is undisputed that the trust was the creature of the personal representative, who's now the trustee, Mr. Robert Goodyear. He proposed the trust in the probate court. David Barron, along with other beneficiaries, objected to it, and it was created through the approval of the probate court over David Barron's objection. The restatement defines settlor as the person who creates a trust. Since David Barron did not create the trust, he's not the settlor, which means this is not a self-settled trust. Because it's not a self-settled trust, the spendthrift provision, section 9.1 of the trust agreement, is enforceable. Now, I think where the probate court made its mistake was in concluding that because of a provision in the trust agreement addressing income tax issues, in which for federal income tax purposes, Mr. Barron and the other beneficiaries were deemed grantors for income tax purposes. And as Mr. Forbes explained both in his brief in this court and below, the reason that that was done was to preserve the sub-S chapter protection, corporate entity protection, for the estate-held entities, Grenergy, Masliat, and the other entities. So that was the legal fiction of treating them as grantors for the purposes of federal income tax only. Section 9.1 of the agreement was broad and was intended to protect the assets, all the trust assets, from garnishment and other creditors' remedies without any kind of qualification. And that should be enforced under Snyder and Brasser.
What about the probate court's alternative rationale that Mr. Goodyear had effectively made a decision to distribute, and distribution was at that point mandatory because the statute of limbs on the tax liability had run?
Well, the distribution, first of all, the trustee takes the position that he still retained discretion to make that distribution or not. And in fact, he asserts that he maintains and retains the absolute discretion whether to make a distribution at all.
Isn't that a matter of our interpreting the trust agreement, though, not what he says he thinks it means?
That's correct. I think it is correct. But I think if you look at the trust agreement, there are other, and it's quite a lengthy agreement, but construing it as a whole, the trustee takes the position, I think with some justification, that the distribution doesn't just happen as a matter of course and isn't mandatory, but he's allowed in some circumstances to require certain conditions, as he did here. He required the beneficiaries, as a condition to the distribution being made, to sign a receipt and release form, which is at page 1150 of part 4 of the record. That was included with the memorandum that the trustee circulated to everyone the day after, in fact, the day after the garnishment was served. That was a memorandum that talked about making a proposed initial distribution, and the trustee made it clear that in order for the distribution to be made, the beneficiaries had to agree and sign the receipt, partial release, and refunding agreement. So in this circumstance, Mr. Barron didn't agree to that. And I think that is undisputed in the record, that Mr. Barron did not sign the receipt and release and did not agree to. Because of that, the triggering condition to make the distribution was never met. And this proposed distribution, as to Mr. Barron, never got past the proposal stage. It was simply a proposed distribution. It was conditional and contingent upon the execution of this release and receipt agreement, which was not agreed to by Mr. Barron, and was not signed by Mr. Barron.
The trust agreement empowered Mr. Goodyear to request a release, did it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did your client below present any evidence or argument that in requesting the release, Mr. Goodyear had exceeded his authority under the trust agreement, as opposed to, I mean, lawyers can argue infinitely over nuances of a release, but did he say per se the release was out of bounds?
I don't believe so. What happened, and this was done, most of this is outside the record, unfortunately, but...
Well, I want you to say what's in the record.
What's on the record is the essentially the argument of counsel that, and as well the trustee, that this was never signed by Mr. Barron. It was not in a form acceptable to him. That's what the record shows.
Okay.
So
there's nothing in the record that would support a conclusion that Mr. Goodyear had violated the trust agreement by asking for the release?
Not based on the record in this instance.
Okay. Thank you.
And because Mr. Barron did not agree to the release and receipt, the distribution wasn't made, and to date still has not been made. And as the trustee asserted both below and up here, the trustee takes the position that under the trust agreement, he retains the absolute discretion in making distributions, postponing distributions, holding distributions back, keeping reserves, and all of that is within his discretion, according to the trustee. Because of that, there was no distribution. The trust funds remained in the trust and under the control of the liquidating trustee at the time the garnishment was served. And so the probate court's conclusion that a distribution was made or was mandatory is not consistent with what the record shows. And in fact, the reality is that my client still has not been paid the distribution. So there was no distribution made, which means the trust funds are still protected by the trust agreement and section 9.1, which has absolute language. There's no qualification to the protection of the spendthrift provision from creditors' remedies.
Did your client ever do anything to require Mr. Goodyear to make the distribution?
Again, that would be outside the record, but...
On the record, he did not.
On the record, no.
Thank you.
He did not. Now, this brings me to another related point, and that's that Marion Barron has asserted, and I think it's in her answer brief to the trustee's brief, that the spendthrift provision in essence expired when the contingent tax liability expired. But I think that would undermine completely the intent of the settlor in creating the spendthrift provision. The spendthrift provision is absolute. It doesn't say this protection only goes until the expiration of this one contingent liability. And that was not the only contingent liability. There is nothing in Section 9.1 that limits it. And therefore, it still applies so long as the funds are held by the trust. And I think that's completely consistent with the case law in the three cases that I cited, Snyder, Brasser, and University National Bank, that even if there were a power, such as some of the beneficiaries have in those cases, to compel the distribution, until that power is exercised, there is no right to garnishment. And here, according to the trustee, Mr. Barron doesn't have the right to compel the distribution. The distribution hasn't been made, and at the time the garnishment was served, therefore, the spendthrift provision was enforceable and protected those assets from garnishment. So for that reason, we would ask that the court reverse and order Miriam Barron to repay the garnished funds with interest to date, which is in the neighborhood of about $585,000, $88,000. There's a second reason why this is not the garnishment was invalid, and that's that there is no executable judgment. Miriam Barron had to bring a separate action to enforce her contribution right. When the $1 million bequest was paid out of the estate in 1997, at that point, the probate court no longer had the power to order payment of that amount out of the estate to Mrs. Barron. Instead, she was required to bring a separate contribution action under 1511-2055. Now, it's undisputed that she never brought such an action, and because she didn't bring an action, there is no executable contribution liability judgment.
Pardon me, Mr. Myrie.
Yes.
Isn't the better reading of subsection 5 that it applies to cases that can be brought elsewhere for the purposes of enforcing an original order?
I think the reading is that it gives the authority for that order fixing contribution liability to be enforced in any court of competent jurisdiction. But there is, if you look at 2054, once the property is out of the estate, the probate court itself does not have the power to order payment. I think that's what 2054 means. And I think that makes sense when you think about the function of the probate court in administering the estate and the estate assets. When the assets aren't within the estate, the probate court does not have the power to order them paid. All the statute would allow is the probate court to fix contribution liability. And as we contend, that an order fixing contribution liability is not an executable judgment.
Help me with this. Doesn't subsection 4 refer to an order of payment from the assets of the augmented estate or by contribution?
Right, but the second sentence talks about if it appears that a fund or property included in the augmented estate has not come into the possession of the person represented or has been distributed, the court nevertheless shall fix the liability. So at the point that the assets are no longer within the estate, the probate court does not have the power any longer to order payment because the assets aren't within the estate. All the probate court can do is enter an order fixing the liability, and then it becomes incumbent upon the person who possesses the contribution right to go and enforce that.
You don't quarrel you don't disagree that the probate court here fixed the liability by approving the plan of distribution that had all the mathematics of contribution in.
Well, we did try to address that in the merits appeal, but there is an order approving what the PR had set forth as the contribution liability. Whether that order has to be independently brought as a contribution action, I think that's what 205 subsection 5 requires. It requires a separate action brought by Miriam Barron. She did not bring that. She just brought a garnishment. So it's our contention that there was not an executable judgment, and because of that, the garnishment also was invalid. So we asked the court for those two reasons to reverse and order the repayment with statutory interest. I'll reserve the balance of the time for rebuttal.
Good afternoon. May it please the court and opposition counsel, Mr. Blair. My name is Teresa Moore. I'm the attorney for Miriam Barron in this case, registration number 15163. Mrs. Barron is the appellee, and she is the judgment creditor in what can only be described as very atypical collection proceedings. I hope to cover all of the following arguments, issues, and points, and let me summarize them here, because there were quite a number of issues brought up by the other side. The central issues are probably the best brief, might not need as much argument. We would summarize this. Mrs. Barron's argument is that under the particular circumstances of this case, the spendthrift clause is not enforceable. The purpose of the subclause is set forth in the approved plan for final settlement and distribution. It's not a case where a family member creates a trust for the benefit of someone else, or even where someone creates a trust for themselves and is unable to shield those assets in the latter case from execution. These subtrusts were set up to accomplish distribution. Especially you, Judge Wood, knows from the merits appeal that the estate administration, from the point of Mr. Barron's death until the estate was closed in September of 2010, was 14 years. Judge Stewart, the probate court, wanted to be able to get the case closed and get the assets distributed. There were important considerations and circumstances requiring some way to preserve assets in the case of defined contingencies. Now, that's not to say, let me back up a little bit. So we're asking the court to look at the particular purpose of this trust and the subtrust in deciding whether or not the garnishment could reach the assets of Mr. Barron on the decision of a distribution or even before them. The second issue argument that I'm prepared to discuss is whether the judgment debtor's failure to comply with the conditions related to an otherwise mandatory distribution from trust prevents his creditors from reaching the distribution. And the reason that I say that this was a mandatory distribution is because that's what the plan anticipates. The personal representative, now liquidating trust trustee, stated in his plan for final settlement and distribution that once the contingency related to the potential gift tax liability passed, there would be a significant and substantial distribution. Mrs. Barron didn't seek to attach the portion of the subtrust that was going to be distributed.
But the trustee was the one who imposed this condition, too.
Correct. And following up on Judge Webb's questions of Mr. Monner, the reason David Barron didn't go back to the probate court and cry foul and say that he had abused and overstepped his discretion in requiring this receipt and release is because he wanted to frustrate Mrs. Barron's ability to recover his pecuniary bequest liability from his trust.
Well, the question is, does this condition have to be satisfied before there can be a distribution?
I analyze the request for receipt and release in this case as regarding the distribution from the trust as what a personal representative is going to require and the probate code allows him to require in the ordinary course with regard to ordinary distributions and outside of a special trust situation. And trustees are required, are permitted, personal representatives are permitted to ask for receipts and release, and they will get a discharge once they have filed those with the court or they have filed proof of distribution. In this case, the trustee, the personal representative was discharged on April 11, 2011, and the request for the release was not necessary. But again, Mr. Barron had no reason to go back to the probate court and say, hey, I need my money. Everybody else has their money. I should be entitled to get my money, and I shouldn't have to be able to sign this stupid release. There was one other condition, though, that the trustee relied on requiring release. It was a release and refunding agreement. And that's because the vast majority of the cash in the trust that was, and in the subtrust that was available to be distributed, was through a settlement agreement that the decedent, Sheldon Barron, that the estate had with the decedent's brother, Robert Barron, over the sale of their interests, the decedent's interest in Barron Corporation. And some of the terms of that settlement agreement that was reached, I think, in early 2000, as a matter of fact, required the estate and therefore the subsequent trust to have to refund, have to pay for certain superfund liabilities, I think specifically is what it was about. But so long as the trustee needed to reserve funds for those contingencies that had been approved and acknowledged by the court, I think it was required. It was, personally, it was fine for him to do that. But by this time, when Mary Barron served her writ of garnishment, we had passed, deadline for the statute of limitations on the gift tax returns. And as a practical matter, I believe that the refunding obligations expired in 2008 and might have been extended bond agreement by the PR and then trustee for another year or two. I can't represent with absolute certitude, but my belief and understanding is there was no legitimate reason to require Mr. Barron to sign this receipt and release. But of course, he was not going to go back to the court and ask for some relief with regard to that because he wanted to frustrate.
So if the purpose of the release has been satisfied, this court can disregard it? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. In the context of this case, and again, you know, Mrs. Barron was entitled to attach anything that chose an action, any property in possession of a third party. And again, the only reason there was a spendthrift clause, a very broad spendthrift clause, in this trust agreement was to protect the trustee so that he would not incur personal liability if it so happened that he had fully distributed everything and these other contingencies still remained out there. And the memo with regard to the distribution talked about what additional funding was necessary or reserves that were necessary that the trustee was going to maintain. But the bulk of the assets that were distributable to Mrs. Barron and to the residuary beneficiaries occurred at that time. The only reason David Barron didn't get his is because he didn't sign the release required by the personal representative. The next issue, it has to do with Mr. Barron's argument that there was no executable order or judgment to attach. On June 19, 2008, the court approved the plan for settlement and distribution of the estate. The absolute exact elective share amount and the proportional liability could not be set until the state administration moved down the road further and we had a handle on what administrative expenses were going to be assessed against the elective share. And that's why we cite the September 2nd, 2010 order approving the schedules that set the amount of liability for payment of the elective share. By virtue of that order, the court ordered payment of the elective share and final distribution pursuant to the liquidating trust. We think there is a payment order, and we don't believe that it makes sense for the court to require or for Mrs. Barron to have to go back and do a separate contribution proceeding in order to get an executable order, as David Barron has argued. Mr. Meyer argued that the applicable section 1511.205.4 is what requires a separate contribution action, but it doesn't say that. It doesn't say that anywhere in the probate code. And instead, the probate code has underlying purposes and principles for efficient and effective and economical estate administration. This court shouldn't read in a requirement when there is no requirement as a matter of law. There's no express requirement that she go. Mr. Meyer argued that because the $1 million request had been paid, the court no longer had the authority to order payment of the pecuniary bequest liability. But of course, the court did. And I think you have to read the language in these sections broadly. The payment order is required by statute. The court is able to order payment of the elective share from the assets of the augmented estate or by contribution as appears appropriate under section 1511.203 and that talks about sources of payment for the elected share, and 1511-204, which talks about, you know, the liability of recipients of non-probate transfers is capped. Of course, the $1 million bequest was a probate transfer. It wasn't a non-probate transfer to Mr. Barron. Mr. Barron makes much in his briefs about the 1997 stipulation as being some kind of waiver. Well, of course, waiver has to be expressed. If you look at the terms of the stipulation, it talks about if the parties can get together and agree that this will be a formal probate, and the parties agree to this procedure that we're going to undertake in order to deal with the complex issues of this large estate and get the augmented estate valuations done, calculate the elected share, et cetera, et cetera, we'll go ahead and pay these $1 million requests. It's our position that it needed to be expressed in there if Mrs. Barron was waiving any pecuniary bequest liability because these gifts were distributed at that time in the estate, which happened to be 2 years, 1 year, 1 year after Mr. Barron's death, but 13 years before the estate could be finally closed. There is no requirement in the probate code that she needed to explicitly reserve this. And as a practical matter, the stipulation also included a savings clause, if you will. Notwithstanding the provisions above, no party by executing the stipulation waives his or her rights under the Colorado Probate Code. At this point in time, the elective share wasn't set. It couldn't be. The values on the augmented estate were not agreed. The 706 hadn't even been submitted. These residuary beneficiaries, especially Mr. Barron and three of his brothers, wanted their $1 million distributions. This was simply an administrative step in what was going to be very long and turns out involved probate administration. The court, getting back to the probate court's ability to order from the assets of the estate, the personal representative actually briefed the court and filed a petition for instructions on this issue and a number of others at one point in time and asked the probate court, can I, when we make final distribution, can I offset the pecuniary bequest liability in what I ultimately distribute or what is ultimately distributed to the residuary beneficiaries? And the court answered and said, you don't have to. But in the course of that briefing, it was clear that whatever was decided, you know, as we were discussing, payment of the elective share from the assets of the augmented estate or by contribution as appears appropriate, we think that the court had plenty of discretion to tell the personal representative go ahead and offset that so that contribution or separate proceedings or other proceedings execution does not have to be incurred by Mrs. Barron. One thing, and I apologize, I don't have the record cite for it, but I would ask the court to consider the fact that in all of David Barron's briefing, there was never a suggestion that he did not have liability for this pecuniary bequest. Or that that it shouldn't be paid or assessed against his share. I see my time is up, although it paused at 3 seconds. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. With regard to this issue of the condition, the receipt and release is a form that imposes certain obligations. One was the release of liability of not the personal representative, but the trustee. The trustee was not discharged. In fact, it's still the trustee governing the fund. So in order to receive a distribution, the trustee was conditioning David Barron's receipt of that upon him releasing the trust and the liquidating trustee from liability in connection with the undersigned's interest in the residuary trust. So it required a release of liability. It did also require the refunding for any potential overpayment, and it also imposed an arbitration clause for dispute resolution. Now, it's not in the record why David Barron objected to it, but he did object to it. He did not sign it, and it was for that reason that the trustee asserted that this was just a proposed distribution that never got past that condition. And because it didn't get past the condition, there is no distribution that had been authorized to Mr. Barron, and there has not been a distribution that was made. And I don't think this court can ignore the trustee imposing that condition and that condition not being met. I think that this case, therefore, falls within Brasser, United...
What about the argument that the conditions for having this signed release have been satisfied and it serves no purpose anymore?
Well, I think that this, first of all, the spendthrift provision protects the trust assets, period. And the trust assets, there are still assets in the trust that are could potentially be sought after by other creditors. So I don't think it's fair to say this is just for the tax liability. I don't think the trust can be read that way. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course, and counsel are excused. This exhausts our docket this afternoon, and the bailiff may not recess.